Today we begin by looking at 2 Kings chapter 11. 2 Kings chapter 11. Verse 1 says, "When Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she arose and destroyed all the royal heirs. But Jehosheba, the daughter of King Joram, sister of Ahaziah, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him away from among the king's sons who were being murdered, and they hid him and his nurse in the bedroom from Athaliah, so that he was not killed. So he was hidden with her in the house of the Lord for 6 years, while Athaliah reigned over the land." Now notice the context of this takes us back to the time when Jehu took over the northern kingdom. You remember in chapter 9, verses 23 to 28, Jehu killed Joram of Israel and Ahaziah as he fled away. That was King Ahaziah of Judah. So now this is taking us back to that time period and saying that when Athaliah saw that her son was dead, then she wanted to destroy her grandchildren so that she could reign. So, verse 1, she killed all the royal heirs, and this included her grandchildren. Notice that Joash was the son of Ahaziah. And it shows how cold-blooded she was. She was like Jezebel. And interestingly enough, if you turn back to 1 Kings chapter 21, verses 21 and 22, you remember when Ahab was behaving wickedly, he was told that his descendants would be cut off. And so notice, these children are actually descendants of Ahab. And what it does show is that God's purposes stand, and often the forces of evil unwittingly fulfill what God says are going to happen. See, there was judgment falling on Ahab's house, and here is Ahab's descendant, namely a daughter, who is actually ending up killing a lot of Ahab's descendants. Now the exception here is Joash. Joash, verse 2, was hidden as an infant. And incidentally, this paragraph shows the folly of wooden Bible interpretation. Some people approach the scripture in a very wooden kind of way, and they'll just take one verse and say, well, it says this right here. And they won't even think about the context in which it's written that explains in what sense it's saying that. For example, in verse 1, it says, Athaliah destroyed all the royal heirs. Oh, okay, there's none left. Well, what do you do with verses 2 and 3? Well, I don't know what to do with verses 2 and 3, but it says very plainly there that in verse 1, she destroyed them all. So I'm just taking what it says. You see what a wooden way of approaching scripture that is. And people often do that kind of thing. They will take one verse and they'll grab a hold of it and just insist on their understanding of that one verse and ignore other things around it that show that their understanding of that one verse is invalid. When it says that she destroyed all of them, when it says that she destroyed all the royal heirs, verse 1, then you can see by reading the rest of the paragraph, it was her intention to destroy all of them, and she did destroy them except for one that was hidden. So please remember that as an example, because various times you'll encounter that kind of thing. Notice the woman who saved the one son. Her name was Jehosheba. She's the daughter of King Joram, and she is a sister of Ahaziah. Now, in 2 Chronicles 22:11, she had an alternate name. Her name there is described as Jehoshabeath. And there we learn an additional fact that she is the wife of Jehoiada the priest. And Jehoiada the priest is going to figure very prominently in this story. Now, there's some discussion about where he was hidden. The translation here says that they hid him in the bedroom, and someone has said that it was not actually a bedroom, but it was a place where the beds, like mattresses and such things, were kept. And other people say it's the bedchamber. So you can see that that is not really an important consideration. They hid him somewhere. Apparently there was an initial place where she ran with this little infant at first. But you can see here in verse 3, it says, so he was hidden with her in the house of the Lord for 6 years. So we're at least saying in verse 3 that he was hidden with her in the temple. So look how this worked. Athaliah achieved her desire. Verse 3, she eliminated her opponents. She reigned unstoppable. And it's very frequent that those who are evil have a successful upper hand. That is very, very common in this world. And it's very common in the church because there are tares in the church. And God doesn't root them out if the church is unfaithful and doesn't take care of it themselves. So often there are people who are evil in the church, and they are allowed to continue in their evil, and they're blessed in their evil acts by other people who are getting benefits from them in other aspects. And so God says, okay, you want to have it like this? You can have it. And so very frequently, you see the same kind of thing that happens here with Athaliah. She's a very evil person, and she accomplishes her goal, and she is reigning. And people might be tempted to think, well, what about God's program? I mean, what about God's promise to David? Here are the royal descendants were destroyed. Can God be trusted? The fact is, Joash is safely hidden away. It only looks like God's program has failed. And many times in life, that's how it looks. It looks like God's program has failed, but we know it doesn't fail. And eternity will reveal that fact. So imagine being a person of faith during this time. It would be a very dark and discouraging time in the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom has run pell-mell after evil, and now part of the northern kingdom is down destroying the descendants of David, and this evil woman is actually on the throne. But in the meantime, there's a little boy who is growing in a hidden away place. So verse 11 tells us how Jehoiada the priest did things in relation to this crisis. Verse 4. In the 7th year, Jehoiada sent and brought the captains of hundreds of the bodyguards and the escorts and brought them into the house of the Lord to him. And he made a covenant with them and took an oath from them in the house of the Lord and showed them the king's son. Notice, he made a covenant with the military commanders. First, he had them agree with an oath, and then he showed them the king's son that had secretly been preserved. And then he gave them detailed instructions, which you see there in verse 5 and following. It says, then he commanded them, saying, this is what you shall do. 1/3 of you who come on duty on the Sabbath shall be keeping watch over the king's house. 1/3 shall be at the gate of the sur, and 1/3 at the gate behind the escorts. You shall keep the watch of the house, lest it be broken down. The 2 contingents of you who go off duty on the Sabbath shall keep the watch of the house of the Lord for the king. But you shall surround the king on all sides, every man with his weapons in his hand, and whoever comes within range, let him be put to death. You are to be with the king as he goes out and as he comes in. Now, notice that this detailed instructions, these revolution events, were to be carried out on the Sabbath. Now you might say, why the Sabbath? Well, for one thing, it was a day of rest. Things would be quiet, and a coup would not be expected. And notice what they were going to end up doing on the Sabbath day. They were going to be killing people. That's a lot of hard work. And breaking down altars and tearing down the house of Baal. That's hard work. Now, this has implications in terms of understanding the purpose of the Sabbath day. The purpose of the Sabbath day was rest and worship. But remember, the prohibition about work is prohibition of doing your own work. It is not prohibition in terms of doing certain things that the Lord commands. Remember, Jesus confirmed this when he got into debate with the Pharisees and scribes about his disciples eating grain on the Sabbath day. They claimed they were working by threshing it out on their hands. And he said, don't you know that the priests profane the Sabbath and are guiltless? I mean, the priests work hard on the Sabbath day doing the religious duties of the priesthood. And so here you can see there is going to be a lot of strenuous labor going on that helps us understand the biblical text in terms of the meaning of Sabbath rest. It's also noteworthy that the temple was a safe place to set off this revolutionary coup, because it's very likely that Athaliah didn't go there very much. So you could have the temple and you could be having a discussion with the military commanders and tell them what's going on and get the thing set up. So their strategy, the position, verses 5 and 6, one-third watch over the king's house, one-third at the south gate, and one-third at the gate behind the escorts. And then, verse 7, those who go off duty shall watch the house of the Lord. What was the reason for this? Because that way he had more soldiers present for this special action. That is, the ones who went off duty were supposed to stay around at strategic places, so they had more manpower to deal with the situation. You can see this careful procedure at the change of shifts to achieve the maximum amount of personnel that would unobtrusively be there. In other words, it would be very normal for some to be coming on at the time others are going off. And so right there at that time, when you have both sets of people there, then that's when you set this in motion. Now, what this means is people, in order to accomplish important things, they've got to think and plan. It's not just, well, whatever comes to mind at the time of the crisis, that's what we'll do. It's you need to think and plan and do your job. And so they were to surround the king with weapons in their hand, verse 8, and put to death anyone who came near. So, verse 9 and following, how did they implement this? So the captains of the hundreds did according to all that Jehoiada the priest commanded. Each of them took his men who were to be on duty on the Sabbath with those who were going off duty on the Sabbath and came to Jehoiada the priest. And the priest gave the captains of hundreds the spears and shields which had belonged to King David that were in the temple of the Lord. Then the escort stood, every man with his weapons in his hand, all around the king from the right side of the temple to the left side of the temple by the altar in the house. And he brought out the king's son, put the crown on him, and gave him the testimony. They made him king and anointed him, and they clapped their hands and said, long live the king. You see, the captains brought their men, verse 9, those on duty on Sabbath and those going off duty. And he armed them with David's weapons that had been stored in the temple, verse 10. Now, I think it's likely that these soldiers that were coming came without weapons to avoid attracting attention and were given weapons at the temple. I think that's very possible, what was going on there. So they stood around the king, verse 11, and they brought the king out and crowned him king there, verse 12. Well, you can imagine there was quite a commotion in the city as this was being done. And so Athaliah heard the noise, and she was not pleased. It says there in verse 13 and following, now when Athaliah heard the noise of the escorts and the people, she came to the people in the temple of the Lord. When she looked, there was the king standing by a pillar according to custom, and the leaders and the trumpeters were by the king. All the people of the land were rejoicing and blowing trumpets. So Athaliah tore her clothes and cried out, treason, treason! You see, she heard the noise, which you would expect. And there is a king standing in his customary place, and the people are rejoicing and blowing trumpets. So the people are happy, and she's very sad. She tore her clothes, you know, this is terrible, and cried out, treason. Now, remember, when Jehu attacked Ahab's descendant, there was a similar cry, 2 Kings 9, verse 23, there's treachery. It's so typical of people who are tyrants They view their own wicked actions as legitimate, and they view the actions of other people as treacherous. So, verses 15 and 16, you find the death of Athaliah. It says that Jehoiada the priest commanded the captains of the hundreds, the officers of the army, and said to them, "Take her outside under guard and slay with the sword whoever follows her." For the priest had said, "Do not let her be killed in the house of the Lord." So they seized her, and she went by the way of the horse's entrance into the king's house, and there she was killed. Notice, they not only killed her, but they were ready to kill anyone who sided with her and followed her, and not in the house of the Lord. In other words, don't defile the temple with her blood. So she was killed as she fled. Then verses 17 and following, you have the covenant that Jehoiada made. He said in verse 17 there, it says, "Then Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord, the king, and the people, that they should be the Lord's people, and also between the king and the people." So you have a covenant between the king and the people, and also a covenant with the people that they would be the Lord's people. And then the people participate, as you can see, verse 18. All the people of the land went to the temple of Baal and tore it down. Now, that's a big job. They thoroughly broke in pieces its altars and images and killed Matan, the priest of Baal, before the altars. So they're breaking all this stuff to pieces so it can't be used again. They killed Matan, the priest of Baal, before the altars, which would emphasize their disdain of the whole system. And then it says, "And the priest appointed officers over the house of the Lord." Evidently, that's Jehoiada. He's appointing officers over the temple. And then he also, in verse 19, he is giving a public procession of installing the new king. It says, "Then he took the captains of hundreds, the bodyguards, the escorts, and all the people of the land, and they brought the king down from the house of the Lord and went by way of the gate of the escorts to the king's house. Then he sat on the throne of the kings." So you can see they're having a public ceremony to emphasize that this person is indeed the king. The result, verse 20, is that all the people rejoiced, the city was quiet, because they had killed Athaliah. So all the people of the land rejoiced, and the city was quiet, for they had slain Athaliah with the sword in the king's house. Jehoash was 7 years old when he became king. Now notice, you have both political and religious action. The first section here, when they were taking action, verses 4 to 16, lacks religious themes. There's an emphasis on political and military solution. And then the next section has religious themes. That's in verses 17 and following. And the people are participating in the covenant and in the religious cleanup. And the literary parallels are striking. So just think about this chapter as we look at a couple details. You have the introduction in verses 1 to 3. And that is the setting that precipitated this big crisis event. And then verse 4, in the military coup, you have the covenant. And then the part where the people are uprising and actually participating in this, verse 17, you also have a covenant. Then in verses 9 to 11, you have the action by the soldiers. Verse 18, you have the action by the people. And then verse 12, in the first part, the military coup, you have the acclamation of Joash in verse 12, and the national participation, the acclamation of Joash in verse 19. And then verses 13 through 16, in the first part, you have the death of Athaliah. And then verse 20, it mentions the death of Athaliah again. So it's sometimes useful just to notice those kind of things where you can see those parallels there. Now, what do you think about this operation? In some ways, it was a great improvement. Vicious Athaliah was dead. That would be an advantage. The Davidic line is restored. That would be an advantage. The city is at rest. That would be good. But not everything is well. And what I'm going to have you do is for next time, study the next chapter to find out what all is going wrong. In other words, many, many times in life, there are situations like this where something really bad was happening and then action is taken to solve the problem. And in some ways, the action is good. But then as you observe what happens, as time moves on, you realize that the action that was taken was not complete enough. And so rather than me just telling you all those things, I want you to study the next chapter for next time and also compare it with 2 Chronicles 24. And in that, you might need to back up and read 2 Chronicles 22 and 23 so that you can see the whole context and try to understand what happened in the years that followed, what part was good, what part was not good, what we find about the characters of the people that are involved. I believe one of the things that's so important about biblical narrative, it helps us understand life. Because again and again, you find these narratives written and they aren't necessarily telling you all the details. You have to piece it together to see what God was doing and how the people were failing and what the end results were and what was really happening. And as we learn to do that with the Bible, because often we have other comments, various places in the Bible that help us know the answer for sure, then we can have our senses sharpened so that we can see things in life and realize what is happening in life. So there is where we will stop for today. And next week, continue on with chapter 12 and also with the parallel in Chronicles. So does anyone have questions about what you're to look for? You can see some good things were taken care of. Some bad things were eliminated in this account. But then what were the end results of that whole thing? And when you see the end results, then you've got to be thinking about how did this ever happen the way it did? Because out of it, we're supposed to learn something.